This sermon is part of our ongoing Mother's Day series on founding mothers of Unitarian Universalism. It's actually the 10th Mother's Day in a row that we've been exploring founding mothers of UU. So we began with Margaret Fuller. Some of you may remember that. It's been quite a while ago now, who, along with Emerson and Thoreau, is one of our most important transcendentalist forebears. Her 1845 pamphlet, Women in the 19th Century, was a significant contribution to the women's movement. Next, we moved on to the three Peabody sisters, in particular Elizabeth Peabody, an author herself who published many of the Transcendentalists under her own imprint and was also the celebrated founders of kindergartens in America. She brought that over from Germany to the U.S. Then we explored the life of Julia Ward Howe, about whom it is said she had 6 children, learned 6 languages, and published 6 books. I don't think there's anything in particular about that, but that is true for whatever confluence of reasons. She was most famous for writing the battle hymn of the Republic and helped found Mother's Day herself through her Mother's Day Proclamation for Peace, which is very much worth revisiting. We've also focused on Mary Moody Emerson, Ralph Waldo Emerson's aunt, whom he called his earliest and best teacher, as well as Louisa May Alcott, best known as the author of Little Women. At the time of her death in 1888, she was the country's most popular author and had earned more from writing than any male author at the time. Olympia Brown, a Universalist, who in 1863 became the first woman to be ordained with full denominational recognition. Lydia Marie Child, a pathbreaking activist for social justice in the 19th century. Cecilia Payne Gaposchkin, we're getting more recent, so hopefully some of this is coming back to you. A woman of many firsts, she was the first to receive a PhD in astronomy from Radcliffe College, the first woman to be promoted to a full professor at Harvard, the first to head a department there, and what has been called the most brilliant PhD thesis ever written in astronomy, she was the first to describe what stars are made of. Last year, our focus was Elizabeth Blackwell, the first woman to earn a degree from a medical school in the U.S., In future years, I look forward to telling you about other founding mothers of UU. Judith Sargent Murray, an early American advocate for women's rights, who was also married to John Murray, the founder of the Universalist half of our movement. Sarah Ripley, an American educator and noted scholar at a time when women were rarely admitted to universities. And Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, one of the first black women to be published in the United States. So my intent with that quick review was not to be like, I hope you remember everything I've talked about on Mother's Day for the past decade. I don't want to overwhelm you with names and dates. Rather, I actually hope your takeaway will be that as Unitarian Universalists, we are lifted up on the shoulders of giants, many of whom were path-breaking women. Remembering these stories of our UU ancestors allows their lives to continue to inspire our work today. In that spirit, on this Mother's Day Sunday, we're going to explore the fascinating lives and legacies of Mary Wollstonecraft and Mary Shelley. Have any of you read this book, Romantic Outlaws? Okay, fair enough. That's Wollstonecraft in the center in the small photo and Shelley on the left-hand side. Now, I may end up preaching future sermons on them respectively, because they both independently lived amazing lives, but I was inspired to try to talk about them both by this book, Romantic Outlaws, The Extraordinary Lives of Mary Wollstonecraft and Her Daughter Mary Shelley by an English professor named Charlotte Gordon, who's written a number of other interesting books. This book tells their lives in tandem, so it sort of tells their birth narratives, you know, one and then the other, and then so it kind of goes through their lives alternating chapter by chapter, telling their lives in tandem. I can both see the value in this juxtaposition. If any of you do read the book in the future, I'll be interested in your takeaway. So I both saw the value in that, and I honestly found it bewildering, because it just kind of switching back and forth in time that sharply. So for this sermon, I'm going to start with Wollstonecraft for the most part and then move to Shelley to kind of keep it chronological. That being said, if the sermon leaves you curious to learn more, the book goes into far more detail, including the kind of salacious details of The Young and the Restless than we're going to have time to get into. Here's the cover of the paperback version that's a little more soap opera. That's Wollstonecraft on the top and Shelley on the bottom. So to set the stage, let me share a bit more of why it is significant to consider the lives of mother and daughter together, as well as, again, why that title, Romantic Outlaws, is appropriate. At a time when women, I think kind of from today's perspective, even there's so much work to do to dismantle systemic misogyny, at that time, women had so few legal rights. At that time, both mother and daughter attempted to free themselves from the stranglehold of polite society, and both struggled to balance their need for love and companionship with their individual need for independence. They braved the criticism of their peers to write works that took on the most volatile issues of the day. They were both brave and passionate and visionary. They broke almost every rule there was to break. Both had children out of wedlock. Both fought against the injustices women face, and both wrote books that revolutionized history. So let's turn first to Mary Wollstonecraft, and then we'll consider Mary Shelley. Mary Wollstonecraft was born in London in 1759. She had a difficult childhood. She had a very abusive father. A turning point happened in 1775 when she was 15 years old. And keep in mind, this is a revolutionary time. So when she was 15 in 1775, that's the same year the first shots were fired at Lexington and Concord that, you know, set off the American Revolution. One of Mary's neighbors at that time had a sense of how hard her family life was and kind of had a sense like, this is actually a neat kid that really has untapped potential. So she invited Mary to tea, and her husband picked up on that same kind of untapped potential of intelligence and curiosity, and he invited the young Mary to use his library if she would like to borrow books. Of particular significance, he introduced her to the writings of the philosopher John Locke, who's known as the father of liberalism. Now, let's be clear, not every teenager is going to respond positively to an invitation to read advanced political philosophy. So, you know, it's like John Locke's Second Treatise on Government? I'm interested, right? It actually is really interesting, but it doesn't sound like it, right? In all seriousness, Locke's writings were extremely influential on the founders of this country, in particular on the Declaration of Independence. Today's Locke's ideas may seem commonplace, but in 1701, Oxford University had banned him, you know, and banned his books from being read because they were such a threat to the status quo. As with many attempts on censorship, this book banning led many people to be more interested in Locke than they would have. Oh, it's being banned. Like, what's that about? Let me be sure to read that. Mary Wollstonecraft was inspired by Locke's views in general, but also in particular his belief that men and women, that husbands and wives, should be equal. His writings helped her explain why it was the case that even though the laws of the time protected her father's abuse, you know, basically said that was okay, even encouraged, right? It was sort of suspect if a father didn't have sort of a heavy hand. It gave her the reasoning to say his patriarchal dominance of the family was actually unjust, it was unethical, and it was illegitimate. About a decade later, in 1786, when Mary was 26 years old, she made her first serious attempt to put her own ideas onto paper, inspired by having read all these philosophers and writers. She ended up writing 49 pages titled Thoughts on the Education of Daughters. She had a few thoughts about that, with reflections on female conduct in the more important duties of life. At that time, no one else was writing at that kind of length about the importance to support young women being independent. 2 years later, in 1788, she published a novel titled Mary, as well as a nonfiction book titled Original Stories, that became a staple of the advice literature on the moral development of children for the next 50 years. She really was quite influential. She continued to write. She became the first female writer who would receive a reliable stream of work from her publisher on a retainer basis. Now, to address why I'm including her, not just because she's important, but in an ongoing sermon on founding mothers of UU, let me be sure to add that from 1782 to 1785, this is when she was in her mid-20s, she attended Newington Green Unitarian Church in London, and their minister, the Reverend Dr. Richard Price, introduced her to this circle of intellectuals and radicals, including Thomas Paine and William Wordsworth, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, William Blake, and the Unitarian Joseph Priestley. This connection is also significant because in 1790, that was when Mary was 31 years old, she was incensed that this same Unitarian minister, Richard Price, was criticized by the conservative political philosopher Edmund Burke in his book, Reflections on the Revolution in France. So 1789 was the French Revolution, and Edmund Burke wrote this book condemning it. She was so angry at Burke, both in general and in particular for him, you know, calling out her favorite minister, that a mere 28 days after his book was published, she had not only written 150 pages, about 45,000 words, but she wrote it so quickly that in 28 days, she had it to her publisher and already had it published. Like, that's like impressive today when we have social media and you can just hit publish. Like, I mean, she really wrote fast. As a point of reference, 45,000 words, that's about 20 times the length of this sermon. I mean, that's a lot. What she wrote was titled A Vindication of the Rights of Man. Here's an author's portrait of her at the time. That kind of makes her look older than she does, but I think she was trying to kind of look stately. That's kind of what she was going for. Even more significantly, 2 years later, in 1792, she wrote more than 400 pages in 6 weeks and published the book that she is most remembered for, A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, with strictures on political and moral subjects. One of her most important arguments is that women's liberty would benefit everyone, men and women, because we were holding all of society back by holding back women's potential and all that they were ready to contribute. I should underscore that Mary's ideas were not merely theoretical. She and her husband cultivated an egalitarian partnership in which they both respected each other's independence, that he'd actually go and write somewhere else and give her room to write, and neither had to assume all of the domestic responsibilities. This arrangement was so unusual at the time, and really for years to come, that 130 years later, Virginia Woolf would look to their marriage, to Mary Wollstonecraft's marriage to Godwin, her husband, when she was seeking that famous "a room of one's own." To Woolf, Mary's marriage was her most revolutionary act, her most fruitful experiment. Keep in mind that this revolutionary egalitarian marriage was the context into which Mary Shelley would be born, so instead of the very abusive context into which Wollstonecraft was born. So she wanted something very different for her daughter. To begin to bridge between mother and daughter, here's a photo from 1797, 5 years after a publication of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, when Mary Wollstonecraft was 38 years old and pregnant with Mary Godwin, who became Mary Shelley. Tragically, this was many decades before germ theory, and the doctor who delivered her did not thoroughly wash his hands, thereby introducing an infection into Mary Wollstonecraft, leading to her death 10 days after the birth of her daughter. Despite Wollstonecraft's death, she continued to be a major influence on her daughter's life. Her daughter was named after her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft Godwin, and her father visited her mother's grave nearly every day of her childhood. Throughout her life, she continued to read and reread her mother's book, often memorizing significant passages. But unlike Wollstonecraft's difficult life as a child, her daughter benefited. She was born into that the circle of intellectuals that took Mary Wollstonecraft decades to reach was just like her daughter's birthright. She was born into that. That her mother and father had been a part of. And through these connections, in 1814, Mary Godwin met the English romantic poet, Percy Shelley. She was 16, he was 21. Their romance became so fabled that years afterward, people were still painting portraits of it. At that time, women were supposed to be demure, but within a few months of their meeting, while they were standing in front of her mother's grave, she boldly made the first move. She declared her love for him and threw herself into his arms. In retrospect, I think they would have been startled to know that this private moment would become world famous, that their kisses would be discussed at literary conferences, in college classrooms, that their affair would be the subject of speculation and a focal point for literary critics. Here's just two of Shelley's poetic musings on these moments. How beautiful and calm and free thou wert. In thy young wisdom, when the mortal chain of custom thou didst burst and rend in twain. Or later he wrote, our church shall be the starry night, our altar the grassy earth outspread, and our priest the muttering wind. Neither mother nor daughter had much use for traditional religion. Here's a photo of her a few years later at the age of 19. Shelley, they did get married, but tragically he died a few years later in 1822. He was only 29 in a boating accident in a severe storm. As with her mother, Mary Shelley is best remembered for her transgressive writing. At this time, I mean, literally this is like when this poem was being written, girls were supposed to be sugar and spice and everything nice. But she wanted to be gothic and horrific and all about unorthodox scientific experiments. The result was the classic novel Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, published in 1818. She was 21 years old when she wrote that. Now, she did revise it later, but still, incredible. Mary was pregnant while finishing the book, and she often called the book her offspring, her progeny. She also alluded to the deep resonances that she felt between the novel's themes and her own life. Like the creature, she felt abandoned by her creator, her mother. Like Dr. Frankenstein, she felt compelled to create. Now, most of you probably know that, you know, the creature is not Frankenstein, right? It's Dr. Victor Frankenstein. That's been conflated in popular culture. Mary Shelley lived until 1851, when she died at age 53, likely from a brain tumor. After Frankenstein, she wrote a number of other successful books, and there is so much more I'd like to say about all the details of mother and daughter and all that went on, but I feel like before ending, I want to be sure to talk a little bit about their respective legacies. To again start with Mary Wollstonecraft, that's a final picture of Mary Shelley looking a little gothic. It would be difficult to overemphasize how prescient a vindication of the rights of woman was. Consider that the beginning of first wave feminism is typically dated to the Women's Rights Convention of 1848 in Seneca Falls, New York. Wollstonecraft's landmark book was published 56 years before first wave feminism started. She was more than a half century ahead of her time. In 1881, almost a century after A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, when Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton published their History of Woman Suffrage, they rightly dedicated that book to Mary Wollstonecraft. In the 70s, with second wave feminism, both mother and daughter began to gain some really, they've been recognized, but they finally got some long underappreciated and overdue prominence. Mary Wollstonecraft is now a fixture in anthologies of philosophy and British literature, of women's literature, and a staple in courses on intellectual history, the history of women, feminist theory. Likewise, Mary Shelley's self-discipline as a professional writer, her originality as a novelist, her seriousness as a political thinker have finally been recognized in recent decades. For now, I'll end with a quote from their joint biographer. Both Wollstonecraft and Shelley, both mother and daughter, they endured significant hardships far beyond what I've been able to detail. They were regularly the recipient of insults, and they lost many relationships over their how radical they were. In order to write words that they, as women, were not supposed to write, in order to live lives that they, as women, were not supposed to live, they sustained themselves by dreaming of a day long after they were dead, when they knew that they had this conviction, one day readers will agree with how we've lived and what we've written. They sort of lived in that hope. That women, that people would come to believe that women are equal to men, that all people deserve the same rights, all human beings, irrespective of sex, that human reason and a capacity for love can reform the world, that the enemies of happiness are ignorance and poverty and cruelty and tyranny, that every person is entitled to justice and freedom, particularly the last, to both mother and daughter. It was freedom that mattered most. It was to them the key that would unlock the gates for change. Just let women be free and see what happens when we let women loose. So in that spirit, let's rise, embody your spirit. Let's sing a hymn that comes out of the women's rights movement, hymn 109, as we come marching, marching.